I'm Keely Boltina, and you are in the moment.
And I'm Kara Hetland. And Keely, can you really tell a tall tale from the truth?
That's my job. But are we talking Paul Bunyan myths, like making lakes with his footprints, or science stuff like how chemicals react? Because there's a difference.
There is a difference, but let's focus on science stuff. And faculty and students at the South Dakota School of Mines and Technology are teaming up for Mines Mythbusters and Super Science. And to talk more about it is Justin Meyer. He's a chemistry professor at School of Mines and joins us now from Rapid City. Justin Meyer, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with describe a myth, and how are you going to bust it?
So my role kind of in this has, we've changed a little bit, but what we do with science is we do try to explain some of the things we're not used to seeing and so forth. I kind of do almost a magic show, showing a bunch of unexpected things with chemistry and physics-related items. In the past, we've looked at specific examples, but we've kind of opened it up more so we could look at a lot more things in a shorter period of time.
So you're talking chemicals, you're talking fire, what else?
What I'm going to focus on tonight is mostly chemicals and fire. Probably light myself on fire at some point.
What?
We'll see how that turns out. And the rest of the event, though, there's a lot of other booths, interactions that people can actually do hands-on experiences and so forth. So it's not all about us sitting up there lecturing and so forth. There's going to be some hands-on demonstrations. There's going to be some engineering demonstrations and so forth as well.
So you're going for the wow factor.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I think the more wow factor we have, the more our point comes across and the importance of science and engineering.
Huh. So let's talk. So lighting yourself on fire, how are you going to do that without getting burned?
Well, there's lots of ways to do it with getting burned, of course. But, of course, part of the idea with it is, again, the myth of fire is everything burns when it's exposed to fire. But, of course, fire is kind of an interesting thing, not to sound like a pyrotechnic or a pyro or anything like that. But fire is one thing that's so unique about fire is it's so unpredictable. But if we understand some of the aspects about fire, like temperature and so forth, you can actually get flames at lower temperatures and stuff like that to make them more safe, let's just say, in a practiced in a safe environment.
Controlled?
Controlled, there's the word I was looking for.
And how do you practice this?
Well, we do a lot of this stuff in a fairly, again, controlled environment. I've done a lot of this stuff multiple times before. Of course, you typically start out slow, and a lot of the things I like to pride myself on is we do slight variations of things so it's not a boring demonstration that they've seen many times. A lot of times, people and kids and so forth see a lot of stuff online nowadays. So we put our own twist on a lot of things with stories and so forth as well.
And do you, preview this with do not try this at home?
I typically say don't try this at home. Most of the stuff I'm going to be doing tonight will be a don't try this at home type event. But I do have a lot of stuff. We do go out to middle schools and so forth where we do a lot of simpler things that are really cool things that they could actually do at home. One demonstration just involves ketchup packet and a bottle of water, for example, and it's a really cool experiment, but again, those are safe, but a lot of this stuff, and we do run into that, people see it online, they think it's cool to try, but can quickly go south if you don't do it in a controlled environment.
So talk a little bit about this ketchup packet and water. What are you trying to do? What's the myth that you're trying to bust?
So it's really cool. Again, a lot of magic is diversion, but the idea is I start out with a ketchup packet and a bottle of water. And the ketchup packet floats to the top, and then I use the magic of mine to make the ketchup packet go up and down. What really happens is the ketchup packet has little bubbles of air in it, and if you squeeze the bottle, the density of the ketchup packet changes and it sinks. So this is something they could do at home to kind of wow, a kid could do at home to wow their parents, for example, without anything dangerous or anything like that. But again, we try to show that a lot of stuff they see in magic, there's a scientific explanation. They just sometimes are diverted away from the practical experiment.
Who's your audience? Who's your target audience for this?
Sorry, what's that?
Who's your target audience for this program tonight?
The program tonight is kind of unique because we probably anticipate a lot of parents bringing their kids, but it's not necessarily all for that. It could be for anybody who's interested in science and likes to see some stuff firsthand. Again, you can see maybe a lot of this stuff online, but you may not be able to feel the heat of the fire or something like that that adds a whole different level. But the idea is largely probably for the parents with their kids. So when we do stuff like this for just schools and classes and so forth, they like to talk about it a lot, but they don't often bring it home and talk to their parents, or if they do, their parents are not sure what the heck they're talking about. So this gives them an opportunity to have the discussions with their parents and talk about what they've just seen.
What would you say is the most popular urban legend that you're going to bust?
Again, I think tonight what I'm going to probably focus on busting is that fire burns everything. So that's not always true. Some things do burn. Some, of course, don't at different temperatures. We've looked at the past at things like liquid nitrogen and how it freezes everything and how that's somewhat true, but there is some other factors involved and so forth. I think that's one of my favorite myths to kind of debunk or to break down. But the fire is something that really can draw people in, and there's lots of different things we can do with fire. We change the color of it. I'm trying to think of some of the other things we're doing. I might breathe fire tonight. We'll see. And stuff like that. But again, with enough practice and stuff in a controlled environment, this stuff can be kind of cool to watch.
How do you lower the temperature of a flame?
And a simple example would be to take an alcohol. Alcohol burns at a certain temperature, but if you add water to it, it'll still burn, but the water actually cools the flame down. So that's a simple example, and one we'll probably be using tonight.
So if you have a fire in your home, don't pour alcohol on it?
No, of course not. Water, of course, does. Eventually, if you pour enough water on it, it cools it down and the flame would go out, of course.
Mm-hmm. And breathing fire, what's your trick for that?
I don't do it maybe the traditional way with, for example, alcohol. I actually use something as simple as cornstarch. Cornstarch is not very flammable, but there's a little trick to making it flammable that I'll do tonight.
What do you add?
I don't add anything, actually, except for air. Put a handful of cornstarch in my hand and then blow it out over a torch, and it makes a big fireball.
Oh, I had images that you had to put a spoonful of cornstarch in your mouth.
That doesn't taste very well.
That's where I was going.
but it also would make it wet, so it doesn't actually powderize as much. So there is a little bit of practicing going on with that. But you had the right idea.
Huh, cornstarch in your hand, and then you blow it. So don't try that one at home.
No. It makes a huge mess. In fact, I've done it once today, and I have to change my clothes.
Let's talk a little bit about chemicals and some of the other myths surrounding chemicals that you're going to try and bust. When I Googled just this topic, for example, it came up with things like, you know, cola being used to clean things or vinegar to cure a cold and those kinds of myths. Are these some of the things that you're going to be talking about tonight?
I'm probably not going to focus too much on a lot of these things when you start dealing with the biological system. They have some, of course, practical reasoning behind them. I always go back to the old remedies for like bee stings and wasp stings. For one of them used vinegar, one of them used baking soda, and it has to do with neutralizing an acid or a base. And that's kind of basic chemistry. I can never keep which one's which, and I know it would make it worse if you go the other way. But there are some underlying reasons behind some of it. But you have to be careful in a lot of these cases where you can take things too far and it's actually damaging. I think I've heard of the myth of hydrogen peroxide will clean your blood or something like that. So people injecting themselves with hydrogen peroxide, which is not just bad, but it could be deadly. So you have to be careful, you know, what route you go in some of these myths. A lot of these myths, of course, are grounded in some type of science. But if you don't understand the full picture, you can make things kind of damaging.
One of the things on the press release said that you're going to also talk about testing household items for radioactivity.
And again, we're going to have a number of, if it's similar to last year, and I'm pretty sure it will be, we're going to have a number of booths set up. So I believe we're going to have kind of an opening presentation, and then for 20, 30 minutes, students will be able to go, or I'm used to students, sorry. The crowd will be able to go around and to different booths. And I think one of the booths will be testing household items for radioactivity. Again, radioactivity is all around us. I think it's a physics is going to handle that. But it's kind of interesting how much stuff is around us, or stuff that we used to use quite a bit, has a little bit of radioactivity. Again, low levels, not going to be, you'll be able to be in the same room as the stuff. It's not damaging or anything. But everything tends to have its own signature with respect to radioactivity.
Are you talking pressing your nose up and watching the microwave cook?
And again, that's a little bit different. That has to do not so much with radioactivity, but more of electromagnetic radiation. So again, sometimes education and why we stress, or why I stress, at least in my classes, one reason you need to know chemistry is so you're not easily deceived by these common misconceptions and so forth.
So if you have the basics, then you should be able to answer some of these questions?
Yeah, or at least be able to find answers. You know, of course, science has exploded so much that no one scientist can know everything about science, of course. And a lot of us focus on specific fields, but we are aware of, you know, some of the stuff going on outside of our little focuses, for example.
Now, you said that this is really for kids to start having this conversation with their parents about science. And walk me through what that conversation should look like, should sound like.
And I think it's probably safe to say that a lot of parents, I've heard it a couple times already today, you know, chemistry was not their strong suit or so forth. And therefore, parents might not be as encouraging with the sciences. They think it's nice that their kids might be interested in science, but if this kids, you know, show a genuine interest, and maybe something like this gives them some ideas of avenues to look into, you know, we can give them some ideas, not just the stuff I do, but the other booths, of course, tonight. But this will allow them to fuel that fire more. I think as a society, I think it's pretty well known that we need more science and engineers. And we need to push those areas. We're not going to get by without it as a country in the future and so forth.
Is this about letting your kids try some experiments at home?
My kids have tried a lot of stuff, of course, at home. But yeah, there's the idea of, yeah, they're not going to, of course, go home and light their hands on fire. But there is the idea of, let's go find a science kit or something like that and see what we can do safely at home and so forth.
I remember talking with a NASA scientist, and he made the comment that, you know, his parents would come home and he'd have totally dismantled the entire dishwasher. And the parents' reaction, you know, I would have probably yelled maybe a little, but his parents are like, okay, great, put it back together. So it's how you react to these kinds of questions, too.
Yeah, and the encouraging instead of the negative reinforcement, of course, is a big thing. And showing parents that their kids, this is something we would love to see their kids do. And as educators and so forth, we want them to go into the sciences and engineering fields. It's not something that only certain people can do. If you have an interest, you know, it just takes hard work and you can succeed.
Sometimes it's just having a curiosity?
Yeah, it's... You know, there's the old saying out there, if you love what you do, you're never working a day in your life. And if you have the curiosity and you want to do science and engineering, that same thing entails or applies to that, in essence.
Okay. Justin, I want to thank you for taking time and coming on the program today. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thank you so much. Justin Meyer is a chemistry professor at School of Mines in Rapid City, and the Mythbusters and Super Science program is tonight from 6 to 7 p.m. At Serbeck Center Ballroom on the School of Mines campus.
I love that they're going to have a bunch of different things. I think that that's fabulous. That'll be really exciting because then you can find whatever you like to deal with.
Right.
You're in the moment. I'm Keely Boltina along with Kara Hetland, and we're in for Lori Walsh.
Welcome back to In the Moment. From roof repairs to mortar on a barn, enthusiasts are infusing money into South Dakota communities to preserve the past.
State law assigns some gaming money from Deadwood to historic restoration. The South Dakota State Historical Society administers the funds for matching grants twice a year, and the latest five recipients are pooling almost $300,000 in public and private money. Ted Spencer is the director of the Historic Preservation Office at the South Dakota State Historical Society, and he joins us live on the phone. Ted, you bring good news today.
Oh, yes. We give out these... Deadwood fund grants statewide, usually they average between $55,000 to $60,000 per application cycle, which is twice a year. So over 100,000 that we give out in preservation grant monies every year through this program.
And this last round, it looks like, is $56,515 of the dollars, and then there's more than $230,000 that are matching. So there's a total of more than $293,000 going into these historic buildings. When I look at the list of the five places, you can go ahead and rattle off the towns where they are, but I want to know, there's so much that seems to be going into structural repairs. And what's the point here with that in these five towns?
Yeah, well, that's the focus of the program is, heritage tourism is so vital to our state's economy. It's about 25% of the total tourism dollars we bring in. And so, rehabilitating and restoring these historic structures is important. And because it keeps that built infrastructure in place historically throughout the state. So this program is specifically focused on brick and mortar work, kind of repair work. We have other financial incentive programs that are focused elsewhere, but this one is basically focused on restoring and rehabilitating those historic structures. And it's pretty much wide open. It can be for a personal historic residence. It can be for an income-producing property or a private historic residence. It really doesn't matter. It's a great program.
Yeah, and we use brick and mortar to often refer to just places that exist in the physical world, but this really is brick and mortar. You're working with mortar and with the roof and, different structural stabilization and wood. I mean, these physical materials are what you're re-establishing.
Right, right. And even, there's the occasional kind of oddity. For instance, for this cycle, we had the Prairie Village Carousel down by Madison, and we're helping to restore the old Herschel Spillman steam writing gallery. The carousel, that's a very important piece of Prairie Village, and it was built at the turn of the century, and it's extremely rare. There's only three of those identified in the entire United States, so it's a great project, and so we're working on the mechanical restoration of that.
And what kind of skills are necessary to have people come out and do this repair work on things from, roofs, or there's a roof repair of the Onion Dome Tower or the carousel? I mean, what skill set do you have to come up with?
Well, a lot of general contractors, lay people can do some of the mortar foundation type work or general roof repairs. But some of the more specific, intricate preservation work, like restoring stained glass windows, for instance, or specific historic facade unique features, or, for instance, the Prairie Village Carousel, that's going to take specialized contractors and capability. And we do keep a list of people on our website that have specific skill sets. And we can't, as a state agency, we can't recommend or endorse anyone in particular, but we do have a list of technical specialists in different fields for this preservation work that's maintained on our website.
I'm talking with Ted Spencer, who's the director of the Historic Preservation Office at the South Dakota State Historical Society. Bear with me here with my public broadcasting background. When I hear about historic preservation, sometimes I go to Antiques Roadshow in my head, right? Where the person comes up and they say, hey, I have this old thing. It's amazing. And the expert says, great, it's been repainted. It's now worth $50 instead of $5,000. So what risk do you have as far as, worth to the community or even monetary value in trying to restore some of these structures? Or is this a different kind of value to society?
Well, it is a different value to society when you're talking about buildings and structures. For instance, is Deadwood, the entire town of Deadwood is a national historic landmark because it retains over 50%, and that's a criteria the National Park Service uses that we work off of. If a community or a historic district retains over 50% of its integrity, it meets the criteria of of being historic. And that goes for individual structures as well. If you have a historic home and it at least shows greater than 50% of the original integrity of that home, it can be eligible for listing or maintain its historic status. That's kind of what we look at. The intrinsic value in that is for a historic district, for instance, if you can retain that integrity and you get that sense of the environment, the historic environment, that means a lot to people coming to visit places like Deadwood. You know, yes, there's a component that come for the gambling and the entertainment, but there's a very large, significant component that come to Deadwood for that Old West, environment, that sense and feeling they get when they walk down historic Main Street Deadwood. They go to Mount Moriah Cemetery. Same as De Smet and Laura Ingalls Wilder, you know, as much as you can retain of that historic setting and feeling, a sense of history, that's what brings these heritage travelers to South Dakota. And that's also what brings pride to the local community. You know, these historic places, the Pickler Mansion, for instance, that was one of our recipients in Falkton. That mansion and that structure that was built by one of our first congressional representatives from South Dakota, Major John Pickler. Falkton takes great pride and prestige in maintaining and showcasing that mansion for the local community.
I wondered about that because I do understand what you're saying with Deadwood and even as that extends to the Prairie Village Carousel. But then I look at some of the other grants that were to, you know, Arlington has one for the Community Museum or the Arlington Masonic Temple. And, Delmont has the Onion House. And so mm-hmm. I just wonder, because people don't usually go to Delmont or to Arlington to get that historic atmosphere. But you're saying that doesn't matter because it's important to the people who live there and have lived there for decades.
Yeah, it has intrinsic value to those local community members that take pride in their place and they want to continue that historic sense of feeling and ambiance they have from their history. And so what we do when we evaluate these applications is we look at, first, is it listed or eligible for the National Register of Historic Places? And once it passes that criteria, then we look at if the work and effort that's going into it is going to be a significant value in restoring, rehabilitating that structure for the long term. And is there documented community support as well? And those are all criteria that we look at in evaluating the applications for funds.
This grant program has been going on for, what, 2 decades now?
Yes.
What happens if this suddenly stops? What happens if we just stop investing in some of these structures that have existed since the late 1800s or early 1900s? What do we lose?
Well, I think we lose our sense of history and where we came from. And I think that's important as citizens of the state of South Dakota that we have a understanding from whence we came. And speaking, you know, as a historian, it's easy for me to speak to my compatriots about that. It's a little harder when I try and, you know, relate that to the general audience. But what I do point out is there are economic benefits and value to keeping history alive in the state and our culture. But programs like this go a long way. The bang for the buck is in the required match, and usually that match far exceeds the 50% match we require. So in other words, for that 50, you had pointed this out, for that $55,000 that we're giving out in grant funds, we're actually getting back in total economic worth over $300,000 in terms of, you know, jobs and contractors and materials and efforts that are going into the communities for restoration.
So there's a little bit of immediate bonus, and then there is that opportunity that people driving through see something, and it feels like history, and it offers a little bit more identity for the people in those communities?
Exactly. I'd like to point out a strip mall in Aberdeen or Rapid City is going to look the same. But, you know, in Aberdeen, Wiley Park, you can only find Wiley Park and some of the unique structures in that environment in Aberdeen, and that's unique to Aberdeen. Fort Sisseton, you know, up there, Fort Sisseton State Park, it's a beautiful restored frontier outpost. You're only going to find that sense, you know, you're going to find that in Sisseton. You're not going to find that, you know, really anywhere else in the state, a restored historic 1860s, 1817s era military outpost from frontier days. So things like that, I think, are unique and are important to maintain for our state. And again, you know, those communities have that unique sense of identity when they keep places like that intact.
And because so many different small towns in South Dakota really do care about their history and preserving that structurally, how competitive is this process for the grants? Are there lots of applications for this money every year?
Yes, every cycle, and our application cycles are February 1st and October 1st are the two deadlines. And we usually receive anywhere from 14 to, on average, 14 to 18 applicants per cycle. We usually award 5 to 6 of those applicants with funds. If you break it out percentage-wise, in terms of the monies available and the applications, the ask, we're only able to fill anywhere from about 20 to 24% on average of the requested funds.
So that
yes,
means
it is a competitive program.
Right, and that means, from my perspective, I guess, as I hear that, that means, you know, you're awarding grants, so those places that need the money are going away. That means other communities are finding things to restore.
Oh, definitely. Lots of communities are finding things to restore. Lots of interest in the program and in restoring these historic structures and sites. Absolutely.
All right. Thank you so much. This is Ted Spencer with the South Dakota State Historical Society talking about the latest round of grants to preserve the structures that tell us who we are. Thanks again, Ted. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much for your time. It was a pleasure.
You're in the moment. Lori Walsh is out today. I'm Kara Hetland.
And I'm Keely Boltina. People think of human trafficking as a crime that happens in the dark, but activists are working to shine a light on slavery. Local advocates are participating in the End It movement. They're reaching out to students, teachers, and businesses.
And these fierce opponents of sex trafficking help middle schoolers, teenagers, and adults recognize the signs of abuse and spot the red flags that lead to manipulation and modern-day slavery. And joining us now is co-founder Polly Dean. Polly, welcome to In the Moment.
Thanks again for having me. I love coming and joining you guys.
Thank you so much. So the End It movement, let's start there with what this is.
Okay, so the End It movement is a national movement where it raises awareness about human trafficking, modern day slavery, and what it looks like. You put a red X on your hand and you take that picture and you hashtag it, and you say, you're in it to end it. And it's kind of, it reaches all different ages, all different businesses, demographics, countries, and it just really shines a light on it for one day where it really sparks a lot of interesting conversations.
And this one day is Wednesday, Thursday.
Thursday, yep, it's Thursday, the 23rd, yeah.
Okay, Thursday the 23rd, put a red X on your hand, mm-hmm. Hashtag in it to end it.
Yeah, hashtag in it to end it, and then hashtag end it movement. And you'll see, I mean, if you click on that hashtag, you'll see people from all over, every walk of life. I mean, it's pretty awesome to see it.
But part of your effort is to then, you know, take this social media effort and this day that's dedicated to it and reach out to people in the local community who might be affected by this. And every time I talk with you about this, I think about it when you say that you go into middle mm-hmm. schools and talk to students. And they just seem so little.
Oh, I know. We still get the jitters sometimes when we stand up in front of these middle school students and we think, you know, maybe they don't know what we're talking about. Maybe we're scaring them. But they're hearing things and they're seeing things. I mean, human trafficking is covered on the news all the time. So the buzzwords are definitely out there and they kind of know what we're talking about. We want to take the stigma away from it and make them not. I don't want to make it a not scary issue. So we talk about easy ways that you can prevent it and easy ways you can prevent yourself or your friends from getting tied up in something like this. This will be the third year that we are spending it at Whittier Middle School. And we just love going there. The eighth graders are super involved. They always want to help out. They want to take on the issue in their own way.
So, Polly, this is Kara. I have a middle schooler, so yeah. I don't think they're too young for these conversations, to be honest. But this is so they don't get caught up as somebody in a human sex trafficking situation. It's not necessarily seeing the signs of somebody who is. Or are you taking care of both topics?
We kind of hit on all of it. We really start with the basics. We say, this is what human trafficking is and what it looks like here in the United States and even in South Dakota. And then we talk about the red flags. We really hit on social media safety because that's probably our biggest battle. It's just all the different social media and app avenues that these exploiters can use. And we say all the things that they could maybe say online, things that they could offer you, all these different red flags. And then we say, listen, if this isn't happening to you, maybe there's a friend that you have noticed has been online a lot or having this conversation with this older man or woman, and it just kind of doesn't seem right. And we kind of give them permission to speak up about it and talk about the issue if it seems wrong.
Because I say to my daughter, even if she goes to the mall with friends, that there could be somebody watching your behavior and mm-hmm. watching how you might interact with your friends. And if you get into a fight with your friends and you go storming off by yourself and somebody approaches you, this could be a sign.
Yeah, and we actually use that scenario often when we talk. And there's a victim that we worked with years ago who almost that exact same thing happened. And we say that to them. They look for those vulnerabilities. And first we define vulnerability and we go over with them what are some vulnerabilities that someone could possess. And we say, like, sitting alone, looking sad, you know, maybe you did get in a fight with your friends, and that exploiter is going to play on that. Say things that'll really swoon you, you know, you don't need those friends, like, you don't need to be hanging out with them, you should come hang out with us. And we say, this isn't the stranger danger creepy person in the corner. This is someone who's going to seem fun and they're going to seem attractive and mm-hmm. you're going to want to hang out with them. It's definitely a whole new ball game.
And what are some of those catchphrases to pay attention to on social media?
We talk a lot about if they're offering different things, if they're offering a place to live, if they're offering a job that pays maybe an exorbitant amount of money or maybe a little bit amount of money, if it seems too good to be true. Sometimes it's a matter of showering someone with gifts. If there's a student who's coming to school who all of a sudden has brand new clothes, they're getting their hair done, their nails done, they have maybe a new phone, things like that that you know they didn't have before, and their boyfriend or this older female friend is purchasing for them, those are all kind of red flags to watch for.
We're talking with Polly Dean, who is a co-founder of the New Colossus. It's an organization in Sioux Falls that works to prevent sex trafficking. And we're talking about the End It movement. I do want to ask you about the fact that you do this work all day, every day, and then there is this one day of awareness, and everybody puts the X on their hand, and then Friday, I mean, does it make a difference the next day? Or do you go back to what you do and they go back to their everyday lives and everybody just moves forward?
Exactly. And, you know, I have to be completely honest that we've struggled with that before, where, like, you know, what good does it do to put a red X on your hand and talk about it for one day? But after years and years of doing it, it really does make a marked difference. There are people who had no idea, and then they happen to see this red X picture and they're like, no way, here in South Dakota, and they really get involved. For as many people who maybe put the red X on their hands and then move on, there are just as many who really get invested in this movement and really want to see change, whether that be, you know, inviting a speaker to your business or having that conversation over dinner with your family. But even the middle schoolers, we encourage them to go home and talk to their family about it, talk to their parents about it, talk to their siblings or their friends, and really keep the conversation going. I think in the beginning, maybe it ended the day after, and it wasn't talked about as much, but there's so much momentum around it now that I really do see a positive from the whole End It Movement Day.
And when a middle schooler goes home and says, this is what I heard in school today, and the parent isn't as educated about it and says, nah, that doesn't happen here, then what? Then what's the next conversation?
Yeah, and that's where we tell the kids, you have that power. You're educated now. And, you know, our whole logo is a torch. And we tell the kids, you know, this issue isn't going to go away with just Ashley and I, or the New Colossus, or the End It Movement. It's not going to go away with us. It's going to go away with every single one of you, like, taking that torch and keeping that conversation going. And we say, you don't have to have a degree in human trafficking to start that conversation and be educated on it. And some of those eighth graders grab that, they really grasp onto that, and they look forward to educating, you know, their peers and their family. We also encourage them, like, hey, if your parents have questions, they can reach out to us. Like, we're an open book. Send us an email if you, you know, want to know more about what your kids heard. We're planning multiple parent nights. We have other events coming up. Come and listen to what we have to say, and we'd be happy to answer any questions. And we tell the kids that, too. If your family seems like they have a lot more questions than you can answer, hey, give us a call or shoot us an email, and we'd be happy to talk to them.
Now, you talk with the kids about, you know, how to avoid getting caught up in this, but then what do you teach about how to see signs of somebody who is?
Yeah, as we hit on the red flags, we really talk about how it would look if someone was talking to you versus how a friend may be involved in it. We say, maybe there's a friend that you hung out with all the time. They were at every school event. And now all of a sudden they have an older boyfriend, or maybe it's an older female friend they're hanging out with a lot, and they seem more isolated. We talk about the fact that these traffickers and these exploiters use isolation as their main tool. They want these people to believe that this person is their only safe place. Their friends don't understand them. Their family doesn't understand them. Teachers, counselors, law enforcement, no one will understand them like this trafficker does. And so we say they may seem defiant. They may seem like, you know, you may initially be hurt, like, my best friend doesn't want to hang out with me anymore because they have this new shiny life with this boyfriend. But it's not necessarily the case. And you kind of have to start to ask some very specific questions. And in the end, it may take going to a teacher or a safe adult. And you might not be that friend's favorite person for a while, but you could be saving them from a life of, you know, the sex trafficking and the violence and the abuse. And in the end, it could be worth it. So we really talk about that isolation factor, things they could be posting on social media. Maybe all of a sudden they're posting pictures with this person, or overly sexualized behavior. We talk about that one, too, where initially a kid's knee-jerk response is maybe to, you know, call that person names or join in on bullying. We talk about that piece of it. But maybe there's something below the surface going on there, and that person's waiting for someone to speak up for them.
You talk about encouraging the students to go to their teachers. It feels like we keep adding things to the list of what a teacher needs to be able to do and recognize. So what do you do when you talk to educators to try to prepare them and equip them with the right tools to not teach math or reading, but to recognize if a child might be, you know, the target of a human trafficking person?
Yeah, exactly. We're in front of educators nonstop. We were just at an elementary school this last Friday morning, and, I mean, it's an honor to stand in front of them because we know how much they take on. And we look at them right in the eye, like right in the face, and we say, we realize that your plate is so full, and this is one more thing that we're adding on to it, but you might be this child's only hope. They may not be learning about healthy relationships at home. They may not have learned about safe social media use from anyone before. And while it's so much to pick up, it's almost necessary so that we can start to work to prevent these things from happening, so that we're not getting these women coming in at 30, 40, 50 years old who have been victims since they were teens, but just didn't have a safe place to move forward. I know that it's one more thing to talk about, but it's a matter of just inputting it into what you're already teaching. And it's not a whole unit on sex trafficking, but it's just lump it in with healthy relationships and self-esteem and self-worth. And safe social media use is something we should be talking about nonstop. I mean, with the technology the way it is with these kids, it's just one more piece that we could add into that as well. And we know that, you know, like I already said, we know they have so much on their plate, and we appreciate when they invite us in and they want to hear about what we're doing and they want to hear how they can help, whether it's just asking a certain question and then handing it off to law enforcement or a counselor or something like that. They're kind of standing in the balance of these kids getting caught up in something this horrific.
Describe for me the safe social media thing, because as soon as I get caught up with where my kids are at, they leave it and go somewhere else, and then it takes me a while to find them and catch up so I can be a creeper. Mm-hmm. So talk a little bit about what that is. I mean, we're kind of past Twitter, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, for kids, for sure. I mean, Twitter is its own platform, but I feel like sometimes when we go talk to parents, I say, I could bring you a 50 printed off pages of apps to watch for and, you know, different things that people might say. But the second I print that out and give it to you next week, it's going to be new. And there's going to be new apps and new rules and new privacy settings. It really is another job as a parent and a caregiver and a guardian to keep up with that and, you know, search Google and be looking for new apps for kids, new apps for teens, chatting apps. How to keep my kids safe on social media. There's so many blogs that are updating constantly with different ways to monitor your kids' usage and different apps that they have. One big thing that we say is when we go talk to kids, we say we're not here to tell your parents to take away your phone and all your social media accounts because it's here. We already have it. It's out. So now we have to learn how to teach our kids to be responsible with it and protect themselves. We can check our kids' phones nonstop, but there's always going to be things that they want to hide or apps that come out that help kids hide things. But if we really teach them that, listen, here's why you shouldn't do this. Here's why you shouldn't accept that friend request or why you shouldn't go meet that person that you think is a friend. Because X, Y, and Z could happen, and sex trafficking just happens to be one of them. And I think once they hear that, oh, okay, I shouldn't do this because this could happen, then I feel like we're giving them that power to protect themselves and their friends instead of one more thing that they're not allowed to do, which as a teen, that's what they see. One more thing I'm not allowed to do. One more thing I'm being told I'm doing wrong. So especially at Whittier, when we talked to the kids about that, I mean, they were enthralled by it. Like, why can't I have this app? Oh, okay. Like, why do you keep mentioning that one specific chatting app? What's wrong with that? And I feel like they do want to know. They're hungry for that knowledge. It's just a matter of starting that conversation with them.
But also what you're doing is it's not the parents' responsibility to continue. Well, it is the parents' responsibility to constantly monitor, but now you're empowering kids to monitor their friends and to know what to look for to speak up.
Yeah, exactly. Because I
can't do it all.
Exactly. And it's natural for teens to not want to be completely open with their parents. So if we empower them to be open with their friends and completely honest with themselves as far as, is this a safe relationship that I'm in, or is this a safe interaction that I'm having on this app right now? And really giving them that power to decide. Same with how we were just talking about teachers. Teachers are just a tiny piece of the puzzle, just as parents are, and business owners and law enforcement, first responders. Everyone's kind of a little piece in this puzzle, but the biggest piece is those kids and themselves, like monitoring their own actions and their friends' actions, because they're the ones who are on the ground. They know what's going on.
Human trafficking is such a heavy topic, and you talked about specifically with kids, you don't want it to be scary, but I wonder how you mesh that with things that you are doing in conjunction with End It Week, like coffee tomorrow morning or a t-shirt and taps events at the Wood Grain Brewery. And I just wonder how you're able to combine that social that social gathering with something that is such kind, a very stoic and depressing topic that this happens in our world.
Yeah, exactly. And I feel like once we grasped onto that prevention piece, that's when we were able to do more of these activities. Once we take away, there are terrible, awful stories. I mean, stories you wouldn't believe that you hear. But once you can grasp onto that prevention piece and really hone in on that, it almost gives people a little bit more hope. It gives them something to grasp onto, and it becomes more, not a lighter issue, but an issue that anyone can tackle. It doesn't seem so overbearing. Coffee with PNC, it's just such a simple thing where, hey, we know it's a scary issue. We know it's hard to talk about. Come chat with us, and we'll answer some questions. No question's a dumb question. We'll teach you how to talk to your teens about it. You know, use a few buzzwords and get them talking a little bit. And how to start the conversation with your employers. And even the T-shirts and tabs, we're kind of taking a venue and an idea that necessarily isn't combined with something like sex trafficking. But we want people to think this issue is approachable. We want people to realize that no matter what you do, where you're at in life, you can have a piece of this prevention that we're working on. The whole zero is possible that we're working on is going to literally take everyone, and we want them to know that, like I said, you don't have to have a degree in human trafficking. Just come learn a little bit from us, watch for those red flags, and you're already, you know, light years ahead of where we were a couple of years ago in this issue.
So you're trying to shift the perspective from we have mm-hmm. to respond and try to care for victims of sex trafficking, which is still important, but we can actually do something about this before we have to have victims.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, victim care is crucial. We absolutely need that, and we need it done extremely well. You know, those victims deserve that. But every victim we take out, these exploiters are looking for four or five more. I mean, we really have to, we're putting the cart before the horse. We really need to get back to the root of this issue and talk to these kids, talk to the potential victims, hone in on those vulnerabilities, and make it so they don't answer that Facebook message. They don't go meet this person who plans to exploit them. Really hone in on that piece.
Polly Dean, co-founder of The New Colossus, thank you so much for talking about End It Week and sex trafficking with us on In the Moment.
Absolutely. Thank you.
End It Day is on February 23rd, and they'll be spending the day with middle schoolers throughout Sioux Falls as well.